celebrating the 10th anniversary of the National Historic Landmark, which is this sanctuary. And today we have a very special person presenting this. Reverend Dr. Jim Lawrence was the pastor here before me, and he was actually my supervising pastor when I was an intern here. It's an honor to have him here, and please enjoy.
Welcome, everybody. It's great to be here. I see a lot of familiar faces, and especially welcome church members, all of you from the arts and crafts community. And what I'm going to do is pace through my... I've become a professor, and now I'm so used to putting PowerPoints together, I thought I would use the PowerPoint approach for the talk tonight. And it's been a lot of fun revisiting a subject I used to spend a lot of time with when I was here during the 90s. And a note that there's this series of lectures is another attempt by the congregation and a lot of people outside of the congregation to begin building a preservation fund for this extremely special treasure. And so we are beginning to raise money and consciousness. And to think about the story, you know, here in the only nationally landmark house of worship in San Francisco, and for a good reason. It's a very special place for all kinds of historic, cultural, aesthetic reasons. The way that this church, through its spirit of, warm generosity, became an open-door church decades before many other churches in the city did for celebrating life occasions, and is one of the most heavily used sanctuaries, I believe, in the city of San Francisco. And the group of people that came together, we talk about two of them tonight, the two older ones, the two geezers of the group, William Keith and Joseph Worcester. The others were all young professionals: Willis Polk, Bernard Maybeck, A.C. Schweinfurth, Mary Curtis Richardson, and I'm probably forgetting Bruce Porter. But they were a full generation below the two that were sort of the God spirits of this creative enterprise. I want to note that of those names I mentioned, it's Keith and Bruce Porter, the stained glass, were the two artists of the group. And the church has already done immense work to do preservation work on their items, especially Bruce Porter, with this amazing restored stained glass, which will be the subject of next month's lecture with a documentary film by Ian Carr. This actually got done, too, in a book that Doug Stinson has done on it. And I guess the film, which I haven't seen, is of the main stained glass over the altar. Keith's paintings actually have also been restored. There was a time in the 90s when we were horrified to see that a candle had fallen against the harvest scene painting. And so it left a scorch mark about like that before it was discovered it was after a wedding. And so taking it to MoMA to be cleaned by the best curator for cleaning paintings in the state of California, we thought, the painting came back so bright and vivid that we realized we had to do all the rest of the paintings as well. And so successively that was done. So the two artists' works have been restored, but there's a lot more that needs to be done, as many of you know from your also long journeying with this space. But tonight I want to talk about the artist who created the murals on the north wall. William Keith notably transitioned from a naturalistic realist painter of nature to a more psychological and spiritual interpreter of nature scenes. Such influences as the American Barbizon School and fellow Swedenborgian artist George Ennis played a role in the metamorphosis of Keith's style, but his unusually close relationship to the Reverend Joseph Worcester, among whose many roles was perpetual art critic, provides a key to understanding the controversial turn in Keith's artistic virtuosity. My thesis today is to focus on William Keith's spiritual commitments and his philosophy as a resource for his art, and to view that thesis through the developmental phases of his artistic expressions in landscape painting. In my opinion, this aspect of Keith's life and work, though always noted by historians, is still underappreciated. So Keith attained in his own lifetime the status as the premier painter in California. At the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915, just 4 years after his death, a separate gallery was devoted to Keith's paintings, the only artist to be accorded such a high honor. His legacy as the seminal figure in the history of early California painting is secured. Keith is always included in the list of important American Barbizon painters, among whom Homer Winslow and George Ennis might be the best known. They were noted for their simple pastoral scenes painted directly from nature. The American Barbizon artist concentrated on painting rural landscapes, often including peasants and farm animals, and the art style featured soft tonal treatments that emphasized a richness in color, a loose and soft brushwork style that nevertheless exhibited accurate and realistic representations of its subjects, creating a richly ambient and usually warm romantic feeling was the goal and the effect. However, in an American art history class, Keith would be considered today a second-tier figure in terms of cultural reception. His renown was at a zenith when he died in the first 20 years after that passing. In the West, it remained strong for a longer period of time, but then slowly declined in American art as other art styles gained supremacy in the 20th century. Keith had a national reputation at his peak, though he has been scarcely noted outside of this country. There has never been a major retrospective exhibition of his work in any major art museum in this country or elsewhere. The strength of his dominance in his period keeps him active, however, as a minor American artist in histories that are given of the period and of American art. But due to one scholar's career devotion to Keith, Brother Cornelius at St. Mary's College in Moraga, an art history professor who met Keith in 1908 and became devoted to him for the next 40 years, there is a significant home for Keith's scholarship and cultural outreach. And it is here in the Hearst Gallery at St. Mary's where there are, as you can see, 185 Keith paintings, and there's a Keith room that is kept in constant exhibition, cycling through many paintings throughout the year. And of course, here in this room, you could continue to look at the slide, but feel free to look to your left. One could make the argument that these paintings have been the most viewed of Keith's 2,000 plus canvases. because of the many, many, I calculate at least 6,000 worship services have happened in this room. There's been maybe 20,000 weddings. There's been a number of other types of events, memorial services, baptisms, lectures such as this, so on and so forth. However, one has to pay attention to the room that they're in, but there's something to be said for this very room being a big part of Keith's ongoing legacy and appreciation and experience and cultural reception in our times. I love to tell this little piece. For decades, it was repeated by many, including me, that the four paintings in this sanctuary were created as the four seasons, as an allegory for the cycle of life. That got started, I think, at the 50th anniversary somehow of this church, which would have been 1945. But in any event, it became a long-standing story. You can't see it actually this well in the way this print came out, but there's a couple of photographs that show why a particular newspaper article in the San Francisco Call, published in 1898, tell the story of why the painting in the back corner called the Old Oaks was actually not in place and not even painted in 1895. These three were exhibited at the 1893 World Exposition in Chicago. And then they came here to be placed as murals in this sanctuary, which was the construction begun in 1894, completed in March of 1895. The chief architect of this project was A. Page Brown. He did the Ferry Building, the Crocker Building on Market Street. Bernard Maybeck was the chief draftsman on the project. Brown was killed in a carriage accident at the age of 39, 3 years after this church was born. And a local historian, Bill Costura, some of you know Bill Costura, I'm sure, came to the church one day in the late 90s and showed me an article that he had found on microfiche in the San Francisco Call, where a journalist writes the story in the immediate aftermath of Brown's death of Reverend Worcester visiting Keith's studio and them talking about their friend Paige Brown. And Worcester saying to his friend, pointing at the painting that was on his easel right then, saying, you know, I think he would have enjoyed that painting himself. You know, as Worcester started to comment on the painting, and he said, perhaps we should put it in his church. And if you measure, the westernmost painting is about 2 inches shorter width than the other three. That's just a fun history story. It doesn't have a lot to do with this lecture. Keith ventured to San Francisco in 1859 for a job as an engraver, which he had taken up as a young man. But when he got here, he found that the company who had hired him off the East Coast had closed down. And so he started his own business along with a partner. He was always an excellent illustrator and an excellent engraver, which is why he was so good as a naturalist, realist painter. And he got it into his head that indeed he might like to paint. And he began his first formal painting lessons here in San Francisco around 1862, working with the noted portrait artist Samuel Marsden Brooks. As he got into his art lessons and falling into the local art scene more deeply, he met and fell in love with a fellow artist, Elizabeth Emerson, and his growing success in the engraving business enabled him to propose marriage. She accepted, and they wed in 1864 in a simple ceremony. They went down to the bay with a simple fare and dangled their feet in the bay water as their first act after the wedding ceremony. She was a watercolorist, was considered better than Keith when he was first starting, and he certainly regarded her as his superior as an artist, but she encouraged him in his own watercolor exploits, and she soon suspected that he actually was far better and that he had the chance to be outstanding. He was soon getting some notice as an artist, and Lizzie kept a scrapbook of every mention in the presses as Keith became better and better respected as an artist, starting around 1866, that he began getting local notice. He then moved to oils when he received his first big commission, which was from the Oregon Navigation and Railroad Company, to paint large canvases of the nature scenes that one could see from the train cars going up the West Coast, and that they wanted enormously large oil paintings. His early works were of Marin County and the areas towards Sacramento and up around Mount Shasta. But by 1867, he was also painting in the Sierra Nevadas, which would become the subject of his greatest works. Soon, the young artist began working exclusively in oils, but his early efforts in this medium were somewhat crude and labored. On his sketching trips, he usually worked in oil on paper and then waited until he returned to his San Francisco studio so that he could work these sketches up on a canvas. Keith became an experienced outdoorsman in this process, became devoted to painting outdoors, to experiencing nature directly, to having long encounters with the natural scene. Few people know this, another extraneous anecdote, very few people know this one, is that one of his earliest students was Gutzon Borglum. Anybody know the name Gutzon Borglum?
Yeah.
Way to go. Yeah, he did a little thing up in South Dakota called Mount Rushmore. He came to paint portraits and to learn from William Keith, who already had a reputation. And Keith told him he had to get outdoors. He had to really get outdoors in order to have the spirit infuse his creative soul and light his imagination. And writing much later in his life, Borglum points back to his first art attempt in San Francisco when Keith told him to get outdoors. And I guess he did. So he needed that, he realized though, his struggling with oils, that he needed more formal training. If he was to become really a significant artist, he could not keep going on his own lights and by the resources he had in San Francisco. He held a successful auction of his current works and in the fall of 1869 left for Europe. In that era, many American painters who aspired to landscape painting chose to study in Dusseldorf instead of Paris. And it was there that Keith went to study with Albert Flam. Although his stay in Europe was relatively brief, lasting a little less than a year, his formal work with Flam and his exposure to European exhibitions introduced him to a wide range of artistic styles and helped him to reach his artistic maturity. When he returned to the States in 1871, he first started painting on the East Coast, especially rugged Maine scenes, where dozens of the successful New York painters summered. He then opened a studio in Boston, and his large paintings of California began to win him some good notices in the East Coast press and also a following of patrons, and some serious money started to flow his way. He exhibited major paintings of Mount Tamil Pius, several that he did of Pius, many that he did of Mount Shasta from different angles. He exhibited these at the National Academy of Design, and then he sold them to California collectors. In 1872, he returned to San Francisco, now a mature and experienced painter. He found that his competitor, Thomas Hill, along with Bierstadt, the great, magnificent, huge landscape, realistic nature painters of the West, had also returned from a period of study, and along with Bierstadt, had opened a studio for an extended stay in the West. Together, these three, Keith, Bierstadt, and Hill, were the big names creating the vast panoramic scenes of the Far West. And they built a wide following for their monumental scenes of the Sierra Nevada and other California subjects. Keith traveled that year, 72, to Yosemite with another local artist friend, Benoni Irwin, and he carried with him a letter of introduction from one of John Muir's closest friends and a new fan of William Keith, a woman named, last name was Carr, in Oakland. It was the beginning, these two, of a lifelong friendship. These are the two who would, decades later, create the Sierra Club, along with a third originating partner who was an attorney. And Muir would become an important influence on Keith's art during this phase of his career. He also proved to be a very powerful friend. Muir was already quite famous at this time and had many connections, and his word was gold. And he was able to develop a lot of commissions and patrons for his new friend whom he admired so much. The only pictures I could find of the two together are later in life. Charles Keeler, another one of the group that came around to this church in the early days, a writer, an artist, an architect, was introduced to John Muir in Keith's studio. And I call it Friends Bearing Torches because Keeler wrote a very lovely memoir with that title that tells some of the best stories about the turn of the century personalities. It's in that book where he tells the story of Bernard Maybeck tromping around the East Bay Hills, coming across Worcester's Cottage, the famous Piedmont Cottage, of which there's one of the three sketches we'll see in a second, in the parish house, and had something like a heart attack. He was so excited with the design of the house. Worcester was not home, but he peered through the windows, saw the unpainted interiors. He had been just returned not long before from France, was having a long training at the Academy of Beaux Arts and very classical style. And Keeler claims that this is where Maybeck got his first fascination with the arts and crafts style. Keeler's a important guy, but there you see the two much later in life, Keith and John Muir.
Excuse me, what was on Keith's head?
Pardon?
What was on Keith's head? Was that his hair?
Yes. Yes.
Go back. Hair. Go back. One picture. Go back. Go. Last picture. Go back.
His hair was quite wild.
A lot of hair.
Right there.
Probably been out in the wild wind. Yeah, Muir probably wished he still had the hair to do that. Because speaking of Keith's head of hair, famous head of hair, one of the wonderful memoirs written about this church's opening, the first couple of years, it was published in Beautiful Home, 1915 article. I can't remember the writer, but she talks about coming here on a Sunday and describe. It's one of the most lyrical descriptions of what happened on the Sunday morning. And she talks about Keith walking in and sitting in his favorite spot, which was on that back bench on the north side of the fireplace, as if he could sort of duck out away. And she says, as if that distinguished head could ever find anonymity. Keith rather soared to fame in what might be called his Dusseldorf period, or even his John Muir period, as he rivaled Hill and Bierstadt in capacity to paint breathtaking, realist, but yet romantic scenes of nature. His kinship to John Muir continued to get stronger and stronger. They took many trips together, including to Europe. You can see all through the 70s, he's at his height as a naturalist, realistic painter with magnificent scale and detail and lighting. He was asked to paint, or he did paint, a lot of 6 feet by 10 feet canvases, these panoramas. This one is called Kings River Canyon. It was owned by Governor Leland Stanford, donated later to the Oakland Museum of California. By all accounts, Willie Keith madly loved his first wife, Elizabeth Emerson, a fourth cousin to the philosopher whom they did travel to meet one time. By all accounts, they had a happy home. They were both very open-hearted in temperament, devoted to one another. They had two children, a girl and a boy that they raised together. Keith was known, commonly remarked upon by people who wrote about him as usually in very high spirits. He was very expressive, kind of a big personality oftentimes, even though he could go into very contemplative moods and long periods of silence. But he was often in high spirits. He frequently sang. He was nearly a solo tenor in quality of voice. He had a high, clear, clean tenor voice, and he sang all the time with enthusiasm. He infused bright energy into the home, and he seemed to find no end of delight in the community of spirit that he and Lizzie created together, which included the care of their growing family. They grew and prospered, and Willie's reputation and success as a major California landscape artist grew all throughout the decade of the 70s. But in the winter of 81 into 82, Lizzie got sick, very sick. Declined rapidly at one point and was dead within days. Caroline Eaton LeConte, of the very well-known East Bay LeConte family, who would become one of Keith's art students later in his famous old studio, his art teaching studio downtown San Francisco. She writes, at this time, he was nearly out of his mind with grief. He was crushed, had hardly a word to say. It was pitiful to see him. There he sat with his gaze fixed, staring at the floor. Keith went on out in those days following the funeral to the cemetery where she was buried, and he painted scenes from her grave looking out from her new spot. Pictures that have been described, I could not find any. I don't think they were ever kept for posterity. But descriptions of others who saw the painting said they were very dark, and with some weird kinds of formations in the skies and in the trees. It appears that Keith and Worcester had already become acquaintances at the time of Lizzie's death through their mutual participation in the San Francisco art world a couple of years before Lizzie's death. Worcester had specialized in drawing classes at Harvard and had developed a deep passion for art. Worcester already had become interested in Keith as an artist and was actually a stalwart admirer of his work. And some say they already had developed something of an artistic spiritual communion. Every testimony we have indicates that Worcester was the one to whom Keith turned to in his grief and upon whom he relied in the weeks and months following Lizzie's death. Besides Caroline LeConte, another acquaintance says Worcester pulled Keith up from the slough of despair and helped him to regain his bearings. Even Keith's second wife, Mary McHenry, who already knew then Keith and Lizzie, and who later would resent the influence the pastor held over the painter, remarked in her later years, "The death of Keith's wife, Elizabeth, left him very lonely, and a new friend, the Reverend Joseph Worcester, of the famous Massachusetts family of that name, became his intimate soul companion for the remainder of his life." Worcester did preside over Lizzie's funeral service, which was held at the First Swedenborgian Church in the city, which was at O'Farrell and Mason, long since torn down. Almost immediately in his grief, he found solace in a friendship that already existed but which started to grow into something else. Mary McHenry was a very well-educated woman with strong intellectual and cultural passions, and by all accounts, this marriage was also, which occurred within a year, was also very happy all the way to the end. There were very different kinds of companions than Keith and Elizabeth had been, but William and Mary, which has kind of a nice ring, doesn't it? William and Mary, were very stimulated by each other's creative side, and it appears that it was a solid marriage. So Mary McHenry knew Worcester very superficially in the post-death of Elizabeth and her new budding relationship with William Keith. And Keith wanted her to accompany him to visit Worcester at his famed cottage. And so out they trooped one day in what is now kind of a famous little story of that day. She writes later, "We talked for a while over the frugal refreshment of strong tea and rye," note that, "frugal refreshment of strong tea and rye bread with marmalade." And then both Mr. Worcester and Mr. Keith, look at the formality in the Victorian era, referring to your bow as Mr., "went out to do some sketching while I remained with Mr. Worcester. But I felt a great repression, a sort of moral tension, which seemed to be increased by the strong tea, and could hardly remain longer. I felt as if I must run out, and I was much relieved when Mr. Keith returned." Another little side note that doesn't have a lot to do with this presentation, I've pondered on what was known as not the closest of relations between Mary McHenry Keith and Joseph Worcester, but the fact that she was the Bay Area's leading suffragette, And Joseph Worcester, who I like to say is my favorite dead Swedenborgian, the worst discovery I ever came across was finding his Phi Beta Kappa address at Stanford University in the year 1910 when he argues against women's suffrage. I wonder if these kinds of elements, there's other political issues that I detect became an issue between Keith and Worcester in one particular way. If I have time, I might tell that story too. But Keith's primary biographer, Brother Cornelius, believes this very possibly was the day and the very occasion when what Keith did when he walked out for a while was to move about 100 yards away and sketch out the scene of the bay with Worcester's cottage in the foreground. Often thought of as the first Bay Area tradition home. Keith and Mary went to Germany, as perhaps in some ways it was a chance to start a new life emotionally. But for Keith, he wanted to remake himself as an artist as well, as the realistic pictures that had brought him such acclaim in the 70s had fallen out of favor with the critics and even with patrons. He was scarcely getting any press notices anymore. There's 100 letters extant from William Keith to Joseph Worcester in his travels, the great bulk of them from this trip in Germany right after Lizzie's death and then the remarriage. And another interesting thing that happened is between Keith and Worcester, when Keith went to Worcester sort of enthusiastic about the prospects of a new marriage with Mary McHenry and a dream he had had in which he fused together Lizzie and Mary and felt that that was a sign, Keith advised him not to read too much into the dream. There's a sense that Keith was not wholly enthusiastic about, that Worcester was not wholly enthusiastic about Keith leaping into a relationship so soon. I'm speculating, however. Keith says in one of his letters from Germany, "You say I write to you too much, but I can only say that it is necessary for me to do so." It's dated late winter, 1883. "I must do it. It is an anchor or a link in a cable attached to the harbor. I told Mary the other night that if I should get into heaven and was asked why I was there, I could only say for excuse that I was acquainted with Mr. Worcester." So every one of these 100-plus letters begins with the salutation, "Dear Mr. Worcester," a figure who indeed comes to grow into an unusually large presence in his life until at least 1910 or so, when they had a little bit of a break. Their friendship was to become more than pastor parishioner, though Keith faithfully sat in Worcester's congregation for 30 years. It was more than mere artistic simpaticos, though they each had an art background and the artistic endeavor dominated the foreground of their relationship. More than just congenial friends, though they saw each other nearly every day when Keith was not on his travels. It was a rare spiritual companionship and was a bond that provided a kind of deep identity. I think that was as important for Worcester as it was for Keith. For Keith, it was certainly his most involved and most complex male friendship, a durable and encompassing friendship that expanded to become a platform and a basis of trust in which to explore the deepest questions, the most arcane professional and aesthetic pursuits, and even to handle business transactions. When Keith came back from Germany, he started painting again, especially portraits, which were usually by commission. But he also kept on with a new approach to landscaping, a new subjective approach. Worcester was to become instrumental in supporting this direction, and the fusion of painter and pastor became a hallmark in Keith's studio for the next 20 years. In Keith's studio, which is where Keeler first met Joseph Worcester, he met Worcester through Keith going to Keith's studio. Keeler had been a student who sent Keith a glowing praise essay of his artwork and asked if he could work with him some, and Keith agreed to see him, and they became fast friends. Famously, Keith only had female students. He would not take male students in as a general rule. He had five in number. Males were too inquisitive and too hard to teach. And he liked the community of the society of women whom he felt were much better students for him, but they could not be rookies. Anyway, in Keith's studio, he meets with Joseph Worcester and says, from the respect and deference with which Mr. Keith received him, it was evident that he was no ordinary mortal. It soon appeared that he exercised a powerful influence over Mr. Keith. Emily Hay is the student of Keith's who wrote the most about him later on, a wonderful book called William Keith, Prophet Pastor, a skinny little book written in 1916, so 5 years after Keith's death. It's largely a first-person account telling narratives that happened in the studio with her philosophical reflections on the actions there, and she refers to the large number of paintings that Keith lost in the fire of 1906. So we know she was a student either continuously or off and on from somewhere in the mid to late 80s till after the fire. And she was certainly there when Ennis came. She writes, here's an average day in Keith's studio, 2 afternoons a week. A light, accustomed step now sounds in the hall, and Reverend Joseph Worcester, the Swedenborgian clergyman, appears, punctual to his usual hour. He will exert a powerful influence over the lives of some of us, for to our restless spirits will he prove an apostle of peace. What has he found, and where has he found it, that something which invests him with tranquility? We too will make search for that mysterious something. Continuing, we follow him to forest depths of introspection, there to discover him seated at the brim of a fountain which he interprets to us as the fountain of life. It is indeed a wellspring of influences, including the doctrine of correspondences, which reveal the natural world as but a shadow of the real or spiritual world. Later, finding the waters constrained by too elaborate usage of sculptured detail, namely the Arcana Celestia, which means heavenly mysteries, and happens to be the title of Swedenborg's magnum opus, but she's using it here as a phrase to describe the mysteries in art, we conclude there must be yet other fountains where the waters well up more freely. So we continue search in the vast forest of religious experience, along little bypaths and tangled wildwood of ever-deepening consciousness, discovering not only more beautiful fountains, but that each and all are fed by yet one profounder source. I like how she concludes. Silently, for an hour, perhaps, Mr. Worcester is lost in contemplation of one painting, the landscape that is then forming on the master's easel. Such prolonged absorption somewhat amuses Mr. Keith, for he himself has not yet sounded the depths of his own thoughts and emotions as read into the forest and meadow by his devoted friend, the clergyman. No, the artist does not yet realize that this is the beginning of self-realization to culminate in Gethsemane. Several important pieces of information come through here. One is that Worcester was a daily regular in the studio. We know that from other accounts also. Another is that he was wholly and deeply present. Didn't come in to chit-chat. Didn't come in to schmooze with people. It was a deep aesthetic contemplative experience for Worcester, standing lengthily in front of Keith's work and perhaps of others. Jumping up a few years, but just to sort of support what Keeler and Emily Hay are saying about the way Keith regarded Joseph Worcester, his favorite nephew, who was a Harvard medical school professor, who ultimately became somewhat well known for geriatric theory and care, early 20th century, Alfred Worcester King, upset, by the way, late in life, the doctors here might appreciate this, many Swedenborgians were homeopaths and involved in homeopathy. And Worcester was, like many of the Massachusetts Swedenborgians, relied on homeopathic care. And towards the end of his life, when he was getting very ill, Alfred came out again and was not happy at the medical care he was getting and tried to get him into some allopathic care as well. But Alfred Worcester and Joseph exchanged correspondence frequently. Joseph had taught him as a young boy, had taught him drawing as well as other subjects. And he reports that visiting Keith's studio, that Keith actually preferred Worcester's presence while he worked. It helped him. He did better when Worcester was there. The stubborn Scot, who could be so strong-willed in some matters, says Alfred Worcester, was often very tentative in the studio towards his art, and he came to rely very heavily on Worcester's judgment as he painted. And in that 1902, well, after the death, he actually writes the memoir from which this is taken. He writes a memoir of his uncle after Worcester dies in 1913. And he said, "On my daily walks with Uncle Joseph, we often called on his closest friend, Mr. Keith. Of course, I could not help hearing my uncle's criticisms, and Keith's imperturbable acceptance of them surprised me almost as much as the freedom with which they were given. On speaking to my uncle of this surprise, he said by way of explanation that Mr. Keith, who was never satisfied with his work, was apt to cast aside as worthless what was really excellent, as he was to keep working away on what was not even worth finishing." Now we come to the last, possibly the greatest influence on Keith. George Ennis is the Swedenborgian American artist who is ensconced in the major leagues in American art history and is, by most accounts, the premier American Barbizon and tonalist landscape painter, perhaps along with Homer. He had fallen into Swedenborg's rapture back in the decade before Keith ever knew about it, when he was getting married to Lizzie in the mid-60s. He fell into Swedenborg's rapture, and in the November 1867 Messenger, New Jerusalem Messenger, which was the national periodical of the Swedenborgian movement, he wrote an article called Colors and Their Correspondence, in which he expounded on the idea that colors possess specific spiritual identities and qualities. In 1968, Ennis and his wife were baptized in the new church in Brooklyn. Ennis would probe the philosophical and spiritual dimensions of the idea of unity between the natural world and the spiritual world that it embodies, with more depth than perhaps any other American artist of his generation. To this end, he engaged deeply from his 20s onward with the writings of Swedenborg. Swedenborg's ideas helped him to formulate his own understanding of what unity meant in terms of his own consciousness flowing through his physical mind and body, of the material and of the spiritual, in which he expressed many times in letters and essays and poems, but especially in his paintings. A central Swedenborgian metaphysical concept understands that the spiritual actually creates the material. It's the realm of causes, and this is the realm of effects, that there's a spiritual influx, kind of a famous inside idiom in Swedenborgian thought, a spiritual influx that is the continual moment-to-moment inflowing of God's divine love and wisdom, of life itself. And according to this doctrine, all natural objects are intrinsically inanimate until they are imbued with life through the influx of spirit. One can comprehend at least one track of divine influx through correspondences, which are specific qualities and attributes of every single particular physical manifestation that makes up this complex physical world. These Swedenborgian ideas, influx and correspondences as the specific channels of influx, was exceedingly prominent in as ideas guiding Ennis during a critical phase of his own development as a Barbizon painter. He also transitioned from earlier naturalistic representations of landscape, ones that were more in line with Cole and Durand and Frederick Church, to more spiritualized representations of his late period. By the 1880s, Ennis was exceedingly prominent both as a theorist and as a practitioner of the American Barbizon style, giving lectures all over the East Coast, writing essays and publications such as Harper's. While this was going on, Keith and Worcester were taking it all in and became greatly interested in who George Ennis was. And Ennis became aware of Keith and was startled over there in New York or New Jersey to find another artist who was not only painting somewhat in the new style that he was advocating, but who was also a Swedenborgian. The only Ennis painting I'm going to show gives you an idea of... Too bad these are not great replications of the art, but Ennis has even more than Keith a gauzy kind of sensibility in the softness of his forms. The forms are there, but the way he reworks the canvas over and over again to smooth outlines and to create an atmospheric over the painting is his famous signature. So in 1891, Ennis came west to San Francisco, primarily for health reasons, but also to explore what was out here. And he and Keith made advance arrangements to spend a good deal of time together. This would change the course of Keith's career. Ennis's visit lifted the California artist's spirits, and the two men traveled together, shared Keith's studio for 2 months, and they held a joint exhibition in San Francisco. Keith learned a great deal from Ennis, whose stature in American art at that point was higher than his own by a considerable distance. The 1880s had been a hard decade for Keith. He had still not regained in 1891 when Ennis came out. Keith had not regained his reputation or his financial strength of the 1870s. The two of them worked side by side, same studio, on two of the days of the week. All the students were there in Keith's studio. Ennis often spent the entire day in the studio, often excitedly holding forth on his theories of painting and demonstrating them to Keith. In a private note to Worcester, Keith confided, "I am a happy man, Mr. Worcester. He is a wonderful man. You know the big picture, the one with the oaks that was going to illustrate all his theories? He has changed it entirely. It isn't the same picture anymore. He has made something entirely different of it. I am learning ever so much from him. I have painted too solidly, laying on the material. And so my pictures have lacked color and are black and white. I must paint more thinly and transparently. That makes color and metal tones." Keith continues in this note, "I no longer want to die since Ennis has come. I have been feeling for a long time that I was just hanging around, waiting. Now I want to work." But that longtime student of Keith's, Emily Hay, has her own fascinating account of those weeks when Ennis worked in the studio. She writes, and this is going to be a little bit of a lengthy quote, she writes in her 1916 book, "It marked an epoch in our free estate when the impending visit of George Ennis was announced. He would share the workroom and easel of Mr. Keith, where we might watch him and criticize him to our heart's content. We found the two men similar in many respects, in personal appearance, but especially in their moods. They were sociable when inclined to be sociable and uncommunicative when they felt otherwise. Both were Scottish of birth. Both professed the doctrines of Swedenborg. Both were dominated by a poetical sentiment. The main difference in their handling of the landscape was based solely on an idea. To our mind, Ennis deliberately destroyed the first freshness of bold strokes by constantly retouching the canvas. Wooly, we pronounced it invariably after he had left for the day, where we could go over and inspect his creation. We don't like his work half as much as yours, Mr. Keith. This naturally pleased, while yet amused, our chief. Emily Hay goes on to confess, however, that Keith continued in his submission to George Ennis and reworked his artistic style extensively, that he continued in his absorption of the techniques of working over the canvas, wiping off the paint with newspaper, working it in with different brush strokes to soften the painting and get an luminous sort of effect. One that, in accomplishing what he was after, was what he called a mastering of the subjective approach. Keith cried out one day, according to Emily Hay, "I have found the path. I found the one true path which I must follow in order to reach my highest results." So William Keith's artistic philosophy and approach changed quite dramatically over the course of a long and prolific career. As he evolved from the immense, spectacular pictures of realistic nature, we haven't even gotten into the portraits that he did, especially into the 80s, many other different types of attempts with creating painting landscapes. But his two big expressions of the naturalistic, powerful big pictures cast in romantic light were changed to these more smaller scale, personal, subjective paintings that he thought better expressed than the realistic, naturalistic paintings, better expressed what was coming through nature and what is present in nature. In doing so, he not only continued celebrating California's beauty and grandeur, but also he continued to give testimony and witness to a spiritual, metaphysical perspective that he felt taught the great lessons of life. And that's what I have for you today.